Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Some of the things coming up on today's program. A really stunning turn for Angela Merkel in Germany. She's changed her thinking on a couple of things. We'll talk about that. There's more U.S. election fallout in the Electoral College and the media. We'll have details about that. And an orangutan has a problem with sibling rivalry in the St. Louis Zoo. She's acting out and causing some damage. We'll talk about that and more this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG. We're live online at kpcg.fm as well, and we have a live link at thetrumpet.com. Don't forget about the TuneIn app. You can use that. It's a great place to listen on the go on your smart device. And this is, of course, the Tuesday edition. Cold today, Grant. I'm Dwight Falk, by the way. Grant Turchin with me here today. Cold here in Oklahoma. Windy. One of those, I guess, traditional winter days we have around here. No snow, nothing really redeemable in terms of the cold weather, but it is cold and the wind's blowing and it's dry. And but you look quite comfortable.
I am. I'm actually really warm because I just had coffee and then I went outside and didn't realize that it was cold.
It's interesting because here in our radio studio, we also have some other operations in the building. And occasionally you see different people walking over from different parts of the campus here at Herbert W. Armstrong College. And you can always tell what the temperature is. You look out there and everyone's bundled up. They look like, they're just completely wrapped head to toe. And they got to make the trek across the frozen tundra of our campus here. So not as bad as it is in some places. Obviously, we don't mean to make too much out of it. But the wind gets going. It gets cold.
Yeah, I see some of the student girls from time to time. And they'll be quiet unless I say, "So how do you feel about the wind out there?" I'm like, "Oh, it's freezing cold."
It is.
That'll really get a reaction from them.
Yeah, and you get dry. Skin gets dry. Mm-hmm. You got to have hand lotions, a variety of lotions in your office to keep your hands from cracking. A lot of interesting things to talk about on today's program. We were talking just before we got on the air about one of the big sports stories from last night. The other day we talked about how Colin Kaepernick had one of the worst games ever in the NFL. Well, last night, Klay Thompson for the Golden State Warriors, he had just a tremendous game for in NBA. 60 points he scored in 29 minutes. 60 points. He was making shots from all over the place. One of those games where I think he could have thrown it up from just about anywhere. It didn't matter. It's going in.
Yeah, I saw at halftime the score was 80-50, so I knew that something must have been happening that was quite extraordinary, but I didn't get to see much of it.
That's what's so demoralizing about playing a team like the Warriors is that you've got three guys that could legitimately have a huge, huge game every game. And it's frustrating to go down there on one end, work really hard on offense, score a good basket, and they come the other way and just shoot up a big three, and it just drops through the net. Right. So it can be demoralizing, and the score can get out of hand, like you said.
It really can. We'll just have to see how sustainable that Warriors team is. I mean, a lot of those guys eventually are going to be extremely underpaid compared to a lot of people who do a lot less.
Yeah, sports is funny that way because you get bigger contracts the longer you play, obviously. But sometimes, especially in the NBA where it's guaranteed money, you have guys that are at the tail end of a contract maybe, or they're not playing as much, but they're still getting that huge payday. And then you've got a guy that's playing great, but he's still on his first deal. And so he's making, you know, whatever, $2 million. The guy's on the bench is making $20 million.
Mm-hmm.
How can that not cause a little friction in the locker room? Like, come on now. You know, look at how much that guy's getting paid.
Apparently it's understood that one thing you never bring up in the locker room is who's getting paid how much. Like, they've tried not to even find out, basically, because it would cause a lot of problems.
Yeah, and if you're a really good player, you make a lot of money on your endorsements. So they get paid a lot more for selling shoes than they do for shooting the ball.
Right.
If they're really good. So it probably doesn't matter to them too much, but it seems like everybody wants to get their money. There's some bad news for the jobs in the U.S. Cereal maker General Mills is going to cut as many as 600 jobs, so that'll affect some people. General Mills, which has been struggling with weaker sales for its cereal and yogurt, plans to cut between 400 and 600 jobs around the world as it restructures its business. They say, like other processed food companies, General Mills has been hurt by America's changing tastes. The Minneapolis-based company has been tinkering with its recipes, adding more cinnamon to Cinnamon Toast Crunch cereal and switching to antibiotic-free chicken in Progresso soups and increasing the protein in Yoplait yogurts. They think that people want to eat a little healthier. So I guess the chicken thing makes sense to me, the antibiotic-free chicken and the protein. I don't get why adding more cinnamon to Cinnamon Toast Crunch would make a difference. Maybe they've had complaints. We want more cinnamon.
I guess that's better than adding more sugar, but Cinnamon Toast Crunch is incredible just the way it is.
I thought it was pretty cinnamony. I think I've had it once or twice, and I've never said to myself, you know, this could use more cinnamon.
Right.
But somebody thought that might be the, I don't know, I guess they're sitting around trying to figure out what to do, and somebody's like, oh, you want to throw more cinnamon in there?
It's hard to believe they're even having trouble selling Cinnamon Toast Crunch. I mean, that would be my favorite non-healthy cereal. So
it's the only thing keeping them in business right now. Maybe they're trying to get all they can out of it. So anyway, that's an unfortunate thing. But, you know, the thing about food jobs and the food industry is that it has been so, what would you call it, mechanized, I guess, or industrialized, where it's a lot of food is produced by just a few major companies. And what happens is when people want healthier options, that's hard to come by because your healthier options are typically going to come from a smaller outfit, smaller grower. And there just aren't a lot of those. A lot of the small farmers over the years have been driven out of business. So you have these huge companies making food, and they're not set up to make healthy selections, as far as I know. It's pretty much just kick out the Cinnamon Toast Crunch or whatever.
Right. It seems like there are a lot of drawbacks to having a big, powerful entity in charge of really anything. I mean, we've seen that in government as well recently. But, yeah, if you have a gigantic corporation in charge of food, do you really think they're going to prioritize health, or will they prioritize profits?
Yeah, it's profits at the end of the day. They need to make their money. So anyway, General Mills cutting a few jobs there. This is a really interesting story here about Angela Merkel in Germany. This is from The Sun. Merkel's U-turn. They say Angela Merkel calls for Germany's burqa ban, or calls for a Germany burqa ban, saying the full veil is not appropriate here, in what they're calling an astonishing U-turn. So she'd been pretty welcoming and, you know, saying, hey, come on, and we don't need to get into that, I guess. But now she's taking a stand. So I just wonder if she's kind of seeing the signs of the times politically in Europe and realizing if she wants to stick around, she's got to get tougher.
That's encouraging to see, because obviously recently we haven't seen too many politicians change course once they've been proven wrong. She's been proven wrong extensively over the last couple of years, especially with the migrant situation. And now it seems like maybe she's admitting it a little bit.
Yeah, she made this announcement at a party conference, having recently declared she will stand for re-election. She told the annual Congress that it was legitimate to expect integration from newcomers, underlining her party's bid to ban the full face veil. She said the full veil must be banned wherever it is legally possible. And she said that to a large round of applause. So you can tell what the sentiment is there. Merkel also stressed her determination to ensure that there's no repeat of last year's huge migrant influx as she seeks a new 2-year term in charge of her conservative party. So obviously, like we mentioned, it seems that she knows if she's going to have a chance of winning and sticking around for a while, she has to capitulate to what the people want, and they want Germany for Germans.
It sounds like she's finally putting Germany first, and why not? Why wouldn't any national leader do that? Don't we here in America love Americans the most? I mean, I love all people. I'm sure you do too, but obviously, if we're in America, those people should have the priority.
Yeah, and just blending into whatever society you go into. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what people traditionally have tried to do, to some extent, I guess, maybe not always. But so it's an interesting change of at least rhetoric for her and what she's saying. They say this comes on the heels of a terrible situation there in Germany. The country is reacting with horror at the murder of a 19-year-old young lady, Maria Ladenburger. She's the daughter of a senior EU official, an Afghan migrant has confessed to raping her and drowning her in a river. So, hate to even bring that up. Terrible story there, but that she's obviously, you know, she's the daughter of a well-known person over there. Her father, Dr. Clemens Ladenberger, is a lawyer who assists the legal director of the European Commission. And so there he is, and he's got this daughter and had this daughter, and this horrible thing happens. And, of course, that makes the headlines. And so people are already a little upset, and these things just push people's anger to the next level.
That's the thing. These politicians' platforms affect real people, and when you're just going to let people come in who refuse to assimilate, who, in a lot of those failed Arab states, treat women horribly, that's just an example of it right there. How can you really expect them to treat the women in Germany any differently?
And, yeah, it's easy to have to make policy, but then when that policy affects the lawmakers and their families, sometimes that can be a change. I don't know what this man's stance was on any of it, but it's interesting. Just you see that in a lot of places where some sort of law is passed or they allow certain things, but it doesn't affect them personally. And if it affected them personally, they would do things differently. I mean, the point's been made, like, you know, the Obama administration's been happy to let people pour into the U.S., but they have a fence around the White House, right? So I think that's kind of an obvious hypocritical situation where it's like, well, if you want to let everybody come in, let them come into the White House, too. They won't allow that.
Exactly. I think it's one of those things where we like to just show pity from afar and not necessarily invite people suffering in Syria into our own homes. I mean, that would kind of be a bit of a sketchy move because, obviously, we don't want anyone suffering. But at the same time, if you know nothing about those people and you invite them into your home, what's to stop them from looting your house and then leaving? And that's just kind of a similar thing there. We let them into the nation, but would we let them into our own homes? I don't think so.
Right. That's an interesting point. And it'd be interesting for the people that are, you know, some of the journalists and some of the celebrities that are out there and they have these big stances on things. Are they willing to do that themselves, take on, say, refugees into their own lives, go live in the Hollywood Hills or, you know, whatever their platform is? It's easy to talk, but it's hard to do it yourself.
Right. And a lot of those people, obviously, the vast majority of those people probably wouldn't do anything too violent or malicious if we did invite them into our homes. But there are a few, as always, in every group who would cause problems. And when you don't know who those troublemakers are, you can't really just let them all in and expect that they'll all behave because they won't.
Yep. So that's a pretty interesting turn of at least what is being said by Angela Merkel there. Something to keep your eye on. Here's a really interesting story. It's from The Wrap. This has been making headlines as well. The Republican elector cites SNL and Rogue One, the new Star Wars movie, as reasons he won't vote for Trump. So here's a member of the Electoral College, and typically they're supposed to go with what the popular vote is in their area. He's breaking ranks and saying he's not going to do that. Republican, and he's written all about it, so I mean he's put himself out there. Republican presidential elector Christopher Suprin explained in an eye-opening op-ed to the New York Times on Monday why he intends to reject Donald Trump when it comes to voting as part of the Electoral College. In a column aptly titled, "Why I Will Not Cast My Electoral Vote for Donald Trump," the Texas paramedic revealed how he will break ranks with Republicans in an attempt to halt the president-elect's road to the White House. So this is kind of an interesting development. I don't know if anybody else will follow him or not.
And he's citing Saturday Night Live and a Star Wars movie for that?
Yeah, that's what's kind of interesting about this. And here's the rest of the details. The days following the response, I believe this gentleman was involved in some ways with the September 11th attacks. I don't know if he was actually working there or had to help out in some way, but he said the days following the response to the September 11th attacks was the last time I remember the nation united. I watched Mr. Trump fail to unite America and drive a wedge between us. Okay, maybe that there could be something there, but I haven't seen any candidate unite anybody, so that would be all of them. And then he goes on to say, he makes a number of references to Hollywood, from Trump's Twitter tirades, they say, accusing Saturday Night Live of cast of bias, which they are, to Darth Vader and the dark side of the Force. He says, "Rogue One, the latest Star Wars installment, arrives later this month. I am not taking my children to see it to celebrate evil, but to show them that light can overcome it," he wrote. So this guy is basing his vote on his own thinking, and he's using Star Wars as his moral compass. So what does that say?
Maybe he's not seeing the true depth of the issue here. It's interesting, too, because when the American people vote, they select electors who the party selects electors who they're sure are going to vote for the right candidate. So clearly there must be some sort of deception going on to where the Republican Party was fooled into electing certain people who will not even be loyal to what the people wanted.
Yeah, and that's what's always interesting about voting in a democracy. People look at the leaders or the people that are running, and you can pick out faults and difficulties, but there are faults in the voters too. And that's the thing. It's easy to blame the leader for something, but what about this guy? Is this the sharpest the knife in the drawer, so to speak? I don't know. I mean, the moral compass that he's using is Rogue One. So, okay, interesting. But then he says, he writes this, "Finally, Mr. Trump does not understand that the Constitution expressly forbids a president to receive payments or gifts from foreign governments." Hasn't that been every president since who knows when? Do you mean to tell me, what's the better option? He wants Hillary Clinton in there? She's played it above board? I mean, come on now. Like, what does he want? Does he want Darth Vader to run? Or I guess it would be Luke Skywalker in this case.
Right. It seems like all of these people who have criticisms are very light on solutions. They don't really present an alternative. They just say, well, I don't like the way it is right now. They start screaming and crying. Yeah, but you're not doing anything to provide a better option. So why don't you just quiet down a little bit?
What's the better option? I don't know. He doesn't really give one. He tries to encourage others of the Electoral College to vote their conscience and try to find the right candidate. Well, who are you going to find? Who are you going to put in there?
How would their consciences be better off if they did their one job, which is to vote the way the people want them to vote, or to betray those thousands and millions of people?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what the guy is saying. He knows better. This guy is saying, I know better, and I know who to put into office because I watch Rogue One. so there's an issue. There's a bigger issue than just the leadership. It's the people, too, and it's all of it. And so a lot of that's brought out in Great Again, which is a really good book you can get at thetrumpet.com, because there's whenever you look at a nation that's having problems, it's more than just the leader at the top. It's also the people. Mm-hmm. So that's what I think is interesting about this guy, is that he's kind of taken this stand, like he knows good from evil, but his moral compass is Rogue One.
Right.
So I wouldn't trust him either.
It's quite the source there for him to decide who to vote for.
It hasn't even come out yet. He doesn't even know what happened. Maybe it'll be different. Maybe he's waiting to see the outcome of the movie before he votes.
There's going to be a pretty big plot twist, maybe.
There's a lot on the line with this movie, yes.
Well, don't they vote on December 18th? Does the movie even come out before then?
Oh, it's real close to that. It might even actually be that day. It's right around there. So, yeah, he's going to be
December
waiting.
December 18th, 19th, something like that. Yeah.
He'll have his popcorn and his soda. And to everyone else, it's just entertainment, but not him. He's learning lessons.
This is nation-altering for him.
Nation-altering. So I just don't think he has much of a point. I don't know if he wanted to get his name out there by writing his op-ed piece or whatever. Usually those people like to keep quiet. They don't want people knowing who they are. But this guy put himself out there. So he'll open himself up to probably some applause and probably some ridicule, depending on whether people agree with him or not.
Well, you said he's from Texas, right?
He is.
Well, a lot of people there probably supported Ted Cruz pretty strongly there, so maybe they would be in favor of him going against Donald Trump in that case, because obviously Cruz and Trump were huge rivals for a while.
Yeah, it also just brings in another layer of, I don't know what you would call it, intrigue into an election. I mean, if this starts happening more, where the people in the Electoral College say, "Nah, I don't agree with that. I'm gonna do my own thing," the whole system starts to fall apart after a while.
Right. There is a purpose for the Electoral College. I don't think anyone has a good argument for abolishing it, but really the Electoral College is supposed to prevent someone who is really just a vile person from taking office. Like if the American people had chosen a murderer, then you would vote against that. But Mr. Trump has done nothing that should really dissuade us from electing him the president right now.
Well, yeah, I mean, his arguments about...
Nothing serious enough, at least.
Right, his arguments about receiving payments from foreign governments. Yeah. Oh, come on. Haven't they all?
Yeah.
I mean, that's... Yeah. I mean, I haven't. Nobody's...
And the thing is, he is doing everything he can to try and bring himself above reproach now by completely separating himself from his business ties, and that's a pretty big deal for him to do that.
Yeah, it is pretty interesting. Here's another story that's really kind of funny. You don't see this too often. This is, I guess, they ship things through airports sometimes from other countries. That's how they come into the nation. And sometimes things come in that aren't supposed to come in, including this item, a stolen mummy hand. Somebody sent a stolen mummy hand from Egypt. It says the blackened cloth-wrapped hand arrived in a parcel at Los Angeles International Airport in January 2013. It was listed as a sci-fi movie prop and valued at $66. But as officials with the U.S. Customs and Border Protection learned, the hand was from a real Egyptian mummy nearly 3,000 years old. They're trying to smuggle it. There's a big market for that, smuggling that stuff in. People buy it, put it on their shelf, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Some people, especially rich people, have the most interesting collections you could imagine because, well, they have the money for it. So why not have a whole room full of basically hobby items?
Yeah, it's really interesting. It'd be funny to have people over to your house. What's that over there? Oh, that thing, that's just a mummy hand.
It's one of those things where you don't want to display it too prominently because you gained it illegally. So you've got to be careful with that if you buy it.
You know what would be great to do is if you had a lot of money and you just wanted to be a practical joker, you could always put that hand in your sleeve when you go to shake hands, scare people.
Have you seen those pranks where the person will shake hands or he'll like – give his debit card to the cashier, and then the person will grab it, and his hand will come off. That's great. It scares the person half to death.
Oh, yeah. It'd make you jump. They say the hand, this mummy hand, was apparently voluntarily forfeited by the importer, and U.S. authorities have repatriated it and four other illegally smuggled artifacts to Egypt as part of an ongoing investigation known as Operation Mummy's Curse. They're trying to track down these illegal imports. And they call it Operation Mummy's Curse. That sounds like a movie title.
Probably did awaken and anger the mummy, so makes sense.
That's why the mummy's so mad. His hand's gone. I'd be upset, too. They say ICE launched Operation Mummy's Curse in 2009 to bust a network of antiquity smugglers bringing illicit artifacts from other countries into the United States. That'd be fun to be working on that case, you know. You have to keep it quiet from everybody. What are you working on? I can't talk about it. Operation Mummy's Curse.
That's the best operation name I've ever heard.
Yeah, it's a good one. At least it fits what they're doing. So that's kind of interesting. I guess, like we said, there's a big market for that, and sometimes those things do come around. We've had some pretty neat artifacts in Armstrong Auditorium, which is just down the way from us. Legally, they came here the right way. We displayed them, and they went back to Israel. So a lot of people came out for those.
And it was very difficult to get them here legally, by the way. A lot of red tape to get through.
And you have to really, yeah, you have to travel with them and make sure they don't get lost in transit. And then I remember when they were putting them on, you know, putting them in the displays, so you think, oh, boy, don't drop that. Don't you drop that. Because how would you explain it? Sorry, I dropped that one, you know, that one thing, that one, you know, whatever the particular artifact was. You can't just go get another one, you know.
After all the convincing that we had to do to allow them to display all that in our auditorium, and then we break some of it.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Thankfully, we didn't. But, yeah, that would have been bad. And we had some earthquakes during that time, too. And thankfully, nothing serious to cause any problems.
Weren't
there,
like, but five more overnight? I didn't feel any of them, but
tonight?
I thought I saw it.
Oh, probably so.
Yeah.
It seems like every day there's a swarm of them somewhere. So, but, yeah, whenever people are going to see artifacts, I think people the Egyptian artifacts are always kind of intriguing because they have so many. The mummies and stuff.
Well, yeah, and they just had a really masterful civilization as well. People still have a hard time figuring out how they built those gigantic pyramids way back then when supposedly the technology to do so wasn't even available, yet they were still able to build them.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing what was done at certain times. Of course, you know, we don't know. They probably did have them. They probably had, like, bulldozers and everything. They were just driving them around. Like, oh, yeah, we had all that stuff. We just lost it. Here's something kind of interesting. Sometimes in sports, people get upset when they lose, and they get on their players a little bit. That happened here at Louisville, the women's basketball program. Women's hoop team surges. They're playing better now after coaches rant against participation trophy culture. He came out against the culture of kind of giving everybody a trophy. Jeff Walz called out his team's lack of effort during a post-game news conference after number 7 Louisville lost its second straight game to number 5 Maryland on Thursday. He also suggested some players came into college hoops expecting to get cheered and celebrated when they didn't earn it. Here's what he said. He said, what's that teaching kids? That it's okay to lose? He says, unfortunately, it's our society. It's what we're building for. And it's not just in basketball. It's in life, he said. You know, everybody thinks they should get a job. Everybody thinks they should get a good job. He said, that's not the way it works. But unfortunately, that's what we are preparing for, because you finish fifth, you walk home with this nice trophy, parents are all excited. He said, no, not to be too blunt, but you're a loser. So maybe a little rough around the edges there, but I think he had a good point, just that, like you said, you know, people sort of expect things sometimes. Like, well, here I am. Where's my job? Well, I don't know. Are you prepared to do it? You know?
Well, we really are in an age where things like that happen. Certain schools have stopped giving out letter grades because maybe a D or an F could destroy the child's self-esteem, which really has been proven by a lot of logically sound people to be useless. Self-esteem is really not a valuable characteristic for a child to have. Confidence, that's important, but to think that you're good when you're not good, that's not a valuable trait.
Yeah, so sometimes coaches take heat for this, but I guess everybody there is an adult, so they dealt with it, and his team responded, and they've played better. They've played better, and they've won a few games. So there's always people come down on both sides of that argument, because some people take it too seriously, mm-hmm. sports, but at the same time, you know, there's nothing wrong with doing your best and coming in fifth, but you didn't win.
Exactly.
You know, it's the way we've all, anybody that's played sports, you know, sometimes you give it your best and you just didn't win though. That's the reality. You have to accept it.
Yeah. It reminds me of when I was younger, I was on a soccer team and our team won third place in the entire league. And so we got a trophy for it. And then I was looking at the trophy and thinking, but there are only four teams though. So why do I even have a trophy for this? It's not that special when you realize there weren't 50 teams. There were only four. We were third out of four.
Right.
That's not that impressive.
Well, it's better than being fourth though.
But even back then I knew there was something bogus about the fact that I had gotten a trophy for something like that.
You know what would have been worse is if there were only two teams and you came in third. What would that say?
I just forfeited every game.
Somehow we came in third and it was only two teams in the league, but we were that bad. Here, of course, this one happened. St. Louis Post-Dispatch. An orangutan's rock fixation causes $198,000 worth of damage at St. Louis Zoo. Orangutan went ape, they said. Can't take credit for that. That one was already written. They said the St. Louis Zoo is nearing completion on a $198,000 replacement of observation windows at the orangutan exhibit after one of the apes broke four of them. So there's huge windows people look at, and they can see the orangutans. Well, they got broken by this particular orangutan. The prime suspect, they said, in the vandalism is Ruba, a 12-year-old female nicknamed Rockin' Ruba by zookeepers, which is a great nickname. They say Ruba tapped or banged rocks repeatedly against four of the six viewing windows over several months this year and finally caused damage. Zookeepers say Ruba was first caught banging rocks on the glass in the spring. The zoo's professional ape care team. How'd you like to work on that? What do you do? Professional ape care.
Very, very exciting job, probably.
It probably is. They say they successfully taught Ruba to instead of bring rocks to them and be rewarded with a treat. But it didn't end there. When zookeepers weren't around, she just kept on banging them on the window. They thought they were so smart. They said, well, bring us the rocks. We'll give you a treat. And she's like, great. And then when they left, she's like, well, I'm going to go bang him on the window again.
Did she break free if she was able to break the windows?
No, I don't think they like completely broke, but cracked, you know, had problems where they had to
replace. Because those must be about the strongest windows out there to keep the animals in the cages.
Yeah, three panes of glass, and it's put together particularly to do that, which is why it's so expensive. But zookeepers say Ruba had a pattern of unusual behavior that began around December 2014 when she was kicked out of her mother's nest. Oh. I didn't know they had nests. Visioning like a tree. This was around the same time. Here it comes. This was around the same time her mother was about to give birth to a sibling, Ginger.
Mm.
Sibling rivalry. You're the only orangutan on the block. The mom says, get lost. We're having another one. And she got mad and started breaking windows.
Kicked her out of the nest.
Yeah.
What a betrayal.
What a betrayal. So the little sibling rivalry going on there. The zookeepers are now hoping to train Ruba to drop rocks in a tube. Regardless of whether she could work at a bank.
You could just take away all the rocks.
You know, when you pull it at a drive-thru, they just put the thing in the tube and it goes.
Imagine if a huge boulder just came crashing down that thing.
Well, it's not the the withdrawal I was hoping for, but they say Ruba became, in essence, the odd person out of the group and her family. She was no longer a kid, but not yet a confident adult. Is that a Britney Spears song?
Awkward tweener stage.
Yeah, that is a Britney Spears song. So yeah, she's an orangutan teenager. She's acting out, breaking windows. That's expensive. It costs them a lot of money.
Yeah, that's sad to see. I thought maybe that was just confined to human beings, but apparently animals can have an inordinate amount of sass as well.
I'd make her pay for it. You're gonna work this off. You're gonna break windows. You're gonna pay for it yourself.
She should have to give up all the rocks. Take out all the rocks. That's her one hobby.
Yeah, get rid of the rocks. She also dug up some concrete and threw that. So she's
so even if there aren't rocks in there, she'll find it somewhere.
She's gonna find something. So yeah, interesting. That's going on at the St. Louis Zoo. You know, it makes me want to go see her. Definitely. Like that story, I want to talk to her and say, look, it'll work out. Like everyone still likes you. We like Ginger too, but you're important in this group. She'd throw a rock at my head. Get out of here.
The mother clearly isn't doing a good enough job of consoling this rebellious teenager.
Do they have ape psychologists? Somebody go in there and talk to her?
That's part of the ape care team.
Oh,
that's
right.
Part of their responsibility. They're falling short as well.
Yeah.
A lot of people just aren't doing their jobs here.
They're just not taking care of her. They put them in like one of those hammocks instead of the couch. She'd be like sitting in the hammock when they're talking to her. How do you feel, Ruba? I just throw another rock at you. Not good. The Key of David program is coming up here in a bit on KPCG, and so is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Brad McDonald today filling in for Stephen Fleury. Talked about a lot of what's going on in Europe, and there's a rise of Catholicism in Europe again, even though a lot of Catholics aren't what you, I guess, would call practicing Catholics. They don't necessarily go all the time. They still identify that way, and that is a group that has a lot of power there in Europe. And so it'd be interesting to see how that develops. Of course, there's a lot written about that at thetrumpet.com. And this Trumpet Daily Radio Show with Brad McDonald talks about it as well. And we'll have a replay coming up, and also you can get it online at kpcg.fm. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau stopping by as well. And thanks for joining us on Trumpet Radio Live here. And you can follow us on Twitter at kpcgfm. Email us any comments you have, comments@kpcg.fm. We like getting those from you. Abraham, this is great for you. This is like 4th of July weather.
That's right. Yeah, it's... Just nippy enough where you feel the cool air, but it's not freezing.
I was talking to somebody else earlier today, a fellow Canadian of yours, and I said, you know, how cold did it get in where his area? And he's like, I don't remember. I think it was like 40 or 50 below. So that's pretty vicious. You ever get that cold?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Air temperature.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. There was a few weeks in Saskatchewan a couple years ago where it was about minus 60. For Celsius, for a good week or a couple weeks in a row, just they had a big Arctic current come down to hit Saskatchewan. But I mean, we dress for it, so we're not up there in t-shirts,
right,
and everything.
But still, do they? I mean, we get like up in Wisconsin, we'd get a cold snap occasionally where we'd have 20, 30 below, maybe, and not usually much more than that, and a lot of wind chill also. And if it was cold enough, they'd close school for, if it was just a day or two, they'd usually close school, which was nice. But they didn't close it for you guys. You just powered through.
Yeah. Well, in Saskatchewan, it's flat. So there's the wind's unforgiving, mm-hmm. and there isn't a whole lot of natural barriers to the cool air moving.
Sounds wonderful.
South. I know it's a natural paradise. They just expect the kids to survive. That's why they... It's a fact, actually. Saskatchewan, kids in Saskatchewan make the best sailors.
Really?
Because the climate in Saskatchewan almost prepares them for how to live on a ship in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean during a storm. It's just similar circumstances.
Oh,
it's just an odd
thing.
The landlocked province in Canada has a history of producing some of the best sailors.
Yeah. Wow. That'd be interesting. They say, hey, we're going to train you to be a sailor. And you're like, great. And they just take you and drop you off there.
Yeah.
And you're like, what do we... It's like the Karate Kid. You're learning karate, but you don't realize it.
Yeah.
So you'd be just like, what are we doing? Just survive. You survive this, you'd be fine.
Yeah. It's like, why am I staying in a cardboard box in the middle of a cornfield? It's like, well, it'll make sense eventually.
Yeah, eventually you'll understand your training. You can't question the masters. as they train you. You've got an interesting story for us today. This is from CBC.ca, and it's been on the news here even lately. Today, Japanese PM will visit Pearl Harbor to pay respects, not to apologize. So some changing attitudes there in Japan.
Yeah, this is interesting because Shinzo Abe will come to Pearl Harbor, and he will visit, be the first prime minister and leader of Japan to visit the naval base. And, of course, tomorrow is the anniversary of Pearl Harbor, and that is the day when Japan did a surprise attack, and it led for the United States to enter World War II. And
you know, there's a I've got this book on amazing tales from World War II, and they have these little stories, true stories, and one of them is about Pearl Harbor. And this guy that lived there in Hawaii, he just liked to fly. He just, you know, he had his own plane. It was kind of a hobby. And that day of the attack, he got up really early to go flying, and he was flying and just enjoying himself. And he looked over and he saw the formation coming, and he was actually sort of part of the formation, almost inadvertently. And they just. He got the hint, like, I need to get out of here. But he didn't realize that it was Japan at first. He thought it was, because there's so much military activity, he thought it was just U.S. stuff. And then he realized what it was. They didn't care about him. They had bigger fish to fry, obviously. And he landed, and he tried to warn everybody. And they didn't believe him. You know, he called people and said, you know, you got to get out of here. So they're coming in. And amazing story. He was just up there minding his own business. All of a sudden, this formation from Japan flies in, and they, you know, that was Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, it's amazing the warning that America did have. I think it's well documented now that President Roosevelt had several weeks advance warning that there was a possible secret order given to the Japanese fleet for the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor. And even today, he sent a message of peace to Japan to try to reaffirm their commitments to peace, even while the aircraft fleet of Japan was closing in on Pearl Harbor. So yeah. It is interesting history, especially in light of all the warnings that we should have heeded, that it still came. But fast forwarding to today, it is pretty interesting that Shinzo Abe is doing this. Especially in light of what President Obama did earlier this year when he visited Hiroshima. And he did everything short of apologizing for what America did there. But as his Shinzo Abe's staff and his chief cabinet secretary have said, the purpose of this visit is to pay respects and not to apologize for the attack. But at the same time, of all the attacks in World War II to apologize for, this is probably the one you probably should.
Right.
Because it was a unprovoked act of aggression, and it killed a lot of innocent people. A lot of sailors died in a pretty terrible death, being stuck in the steel ships as they sunk to the bottom of the harbor. And so of all steps to take towards reconciliation and burying the hatchet between the two countries, you think that would be one of the first steps, but it's actually one thing I don't think any Japanese leader will dare do, because even though America did liberalize Japan in a major way, especially when General MacArthur was in charge of it, Japanese culture does have a worship for the warrior, like it has a very militant warrior culture worship. And while that's been suppressed, I think there is a big segment of Japan that's still proud of the war and the achievements of Japan in the past, and so to apologize for that, I think, would alienate a pretty big segment of Japanese society.
Well, and he's been the leader there in Japan. He's been pretty more militaristic too, which is a real change for them, because obviously after World War II they weren't supposed to have a military. They weren't supposed to certainly do anything outside of maybe self-defense, and even there the U.S. was the one that was going to protect them. So we have a really good book at thetrumpet.com. It's a free one, of course, Russia and China and Prophecy. It's been revamped. So if you saw the old one, you get the new one too. And they go through, of course, Japan and what they're up to today, and they're changing their thinking. They're changing what they're doing. There have been some pretty big changes over the last few years, and they are becoming more militaristic. And so it is interesting to see them revisit some of this past history, but again, with no apology, no attitude change about it. And you know, like you said, it was an unprovoked attack. It's different. It's different than Hiroshima. You know, even though the destruction in Hiroshima was greater, we were at war. And, you know, it was going to go one way or the other. Supreme force is going to win, and that's the way it went about, or it came about. But this was an unprovoked thing, and, you know, like they say, we got bombed into the war. So at the end of the day, maybe that was what was needed, unfortunately, to get us kickstarted. But just, yeah, different. People sometimes look at, like, the death toll or something and think, like, well, they're similar, or, you know, Hiroshima is worse, or Nagasaki. But you have to look at the attitude and why it happened, and that really, they're different situations.
Yeah, always have to keep in mind the context of why nations act a certain way in Japan at the time. I mean, they were already at war in China. I mean, Nanking had already happened. American sailors witnessed the rape of Nanking because there was ships stationed just off the coast there of the city. So they knew Japan was at war and that they were rapidly expanding in Asia. And it is interesting to reflect, as you said, that Japanese troops for the first time have been deployed internationally and into Sudan, I believe, in a peacekeeping mission. And that's the first time Japanese troops have been used anywhere outside of Japan. And even their constitution, created by MacArthur, banished their use of a military because the U.S. Army would be their military if they needed defense. But since America is really withdrawn from Asia, even though we've pivoted to Asia, we haven't really done anything, especially in Japan. And so Shinzo Abe has really seized that opportunity to change the constitution and give Japan a defense force, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. But even though it could very well be used for offensive purposes.
And their industrial complex could rival the U.S. in terms of military production. So they are a major player to consider if they decided to turn that machine on. Or maybe they have.
Yeah, I think they're in the top five economies in the world. And so they do have a huge capacity. And, of course, they always have the same weakness that they're an island. And so they have to import everything that they use for the most part. But it is an interesting change in attitude here for Shinzo Abe, and that the military past of Japan is being resurrected. And it does remind me, when I was on Corregidor, our tour guide, she told us a story of how Japanese military veterans, when they come to Corregidor, not all of them, but some of them, they bring Japanese flags, and they still claim that Corregidor is Japanese, and it'll always be Japanese because they conquered it. And so there's still an attitude, an extreme attitude among some in Japan. And so for Japan to be remilitarized and become aggressive again, I don't think it's that far of a stretch, especially with American influence leaving, just like in Germany. Those two enemies who became allies after the war, as American influence withdraws, the old tendency of militarism return. And that's really what we're seeing in Asia and Europe at this time.
Yeah, and I think that's the big mistake in U.S. isolationism and withdrawing. Now, granted, I mean, we have an economic problem. How do you pay for it? But still, if you pull back, what happens? They fill the gap. And so now, instead of, you know, the U.S. protecting Japan, they're going to protect themselves. And defense turns into offense pretty quickly. Europe will protect themselves. So, that's what Donald Trump has said he wants to do, make them pay their fair share. You have to be careful what you wish for. They will. They will pay their fair share, and then you've got some serious military enemies to deal with.
Yeah, they might not pay you with money either.
yeah.
So that's always something to remember, especially with how weak America was before World War II militarily and how soft our foreign policy was. It is interesting to think of human nature, and that it doesn't change, and that you can't always trust people, even though for decades they may have been going one direction. It's hard to trust certain nations who have a history of being opposed and enemies of you.
Yeah, for sure, because even like you were saying earlier, you know, right before the Pearl Harbor attack, we were looking for, like, peace agreements. You still want peace, right? Oh, of course we do. I mean, it's war. People lie all the time, so I don't know why that's surprising. But it's an unfortunate situation there. So, but interesting to see this how this happens here. Japanese PM will visit Pearl Harbor to pay respects, not to apologize, and that's coming up here pretty soon. And it's interesting too, Abe. You know, we call you Abe. We should call you Abe Blondeau.
Right. Well, whenever I read statements that says Abe won't apologize for this. I'm like, what are they talking about? Then, but it's actually it's Abe. So it's when he was elected, it was just interesting because all on Twitter, the news headlines is Abe changes constitution. Abe elected to be prime minister. I'm like, no, I wasn't.
And you woke up and you thought it's about time. It's yeah. My plan is finally coming into fruition.
Yeah, it's like finally I'm popular somewhere.
But you would never change the constitution, though.
No. Maybe just allow ice hockey or something like that. But
I would love for you two to meet and see the introduction. You know, Abe. Abe. First name basis here. Well, I guess that's his last name. Is it his last or his first?
Is it his last?
Okay.
Shinzo's his.
Because sometimes name. With the Chinese names, it's actually reversed, isn't it?
Right.
Because Yao Ming was saying we were calling him the wrong name all these years.
Yeah.
His name's actually Yao, or something right. like it's different than how we thought it was. So I'm always confused on that.
But, he just tells us after his career's long over.
Yeah. He said, "Oh, by the way, you guys are calling me the wrong name all these years."
Wonder if Yao Ming stands for weak ankles in Chinese, but that's when I think of Yao Ming, that's the only thing I remember from his career.
Well, that guy was a monster in terms of size, like 7'6", and wide too. I got to see him play live once when he was here in Oklahoma City playing, and he wasn't a real tall, thin guy. He was a wide fellow, but it's hard to lug that body around.
Yeah,
you're not gonna have a long career when you're that big. So that's the reason Grant can't play anymore. 8 feet tall over here.
Yeah.
He still plays. He gets out. He gets out and plays. Interesting story here, Grant. The limits of outrage. Liberal journalists coming to grips with Trump's win, Hillary's loss. Finally. The mourning is ending.
Maybe. That's still up in the air. But apparently they're on their way, at least, even though they're basically appalled by everything he's doing.
Yeah.
Even now, every time he tweets and basically gets around the media being the middleman from him to the public, they're saying, this is not how it's supposed to be done, even though the way they covered the entire election is not how it's supposed to be done either. They're not really acknowledging their own part or their own fault in the matter.
Yeah, they're like this sort of, they're just this old massive machine that isn't as useful as it used to be, and yet they can't let go of the thought that they have a lot of influence. And they still do have a lot of influence, but like you say, I mean, people just tweet things, and that you can find out directly from the horse's mouth, as they say. You don't have to wait for, you know, the spin masters at the Washington Post to turn it around for you, or whoever else.
And Mr. Trump has responded to a lot of the media's complaints that he is basically subverting them by tweeting. He wrote in a tweet yesterday, "If the press would cover me accurately and honorably, I would have far less reason to tweet. Sadly, I don't know if that will ever happen." And so that obviously riled them up some more. He hasn't been getting too much credit for conciliatory gestures, like the somewhat alarming number of Democrats he's been meeting with in the Trump Tower. That apparently isn't placating the media very much at all, even though it should. He's even met with Al Gore about the horrifying reality of climate change.
Right. Yeah, they were trying to come to some common ground on it, apparently. Which would have been an interesting meeting to listen to. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I think if the election showed us something, if you want to give Donald Trump credit, he was a master at telling people a message that they wanted to hear and subverting the media. He didn't have to use them. He could go around them. And he's still doing it. And every time he sends out a tweet, it's like he throws a stone into the pond, right? The ripples.
Oh, did you hear what he said?
They're going crazy. I can imagine them just sitting around in the newsroom, like all watching Twitter. Like, did he do anything?
Refreshing it constantly.
Yeah. Yeah. He sent something, you know, and then they go type up their essay for the day.
Exactly. Yeah. It's interesting because some of these prominent media names are now saying maybe we should crank it down a notch and stop screaming that he's a racist and a bigot every time. I believe on election night, I mentioned that I saw an article that had from the Huffington Post that had an editor's note that says that Mr. Trump is a xenophobe, an Islamophobe, a transphobe, a homophobe, all these different things. And apparently that was on every single article about Mr. Trump. I wasn't sure at the time, but yeah, every article that mentioned him at all had that editor's note at the bottom.
It's like that Mad Libs. Right, like they put all that stuff in there, and you just have to fill in the blanks. And there's your article for the day. So there's a template already made.
Right. Yeah. It was really sad how the media did cover it, and that did alienate a lot of people where basically they put up this false moral equivalency. If you like Hillary Clinton, it means that you favor equality for women, which has nothing to do with an election. I mean, people are not going to ever vote for someone based on gender, at least overall. I mean, it got close this year, but you can't just vote for a woman because she's a woman, or a man because he's a man, or a white person because he's white, or a black person because he's black, even though we have seen that happen as well. But that is really a shallow reason. But they'll say, you know, if you voted for Hillary Clinton, you're not a sexist. If you voted for Mr. Trump, you're a racist and a bigot. And that's the only reason you could possibly be voting for him. Not because he has a good economic message, not anything else. That's what the media did. They basically said you're a bad person if you even think of voting for Mr. Trump.
Yeah, well, that's kind of how they had to set it up, I guess, because they couldn't really run necessarily on record, right, or on issues. So they tried to make it about, you know, good person versus bad person. And more people were interested in the issues in general. So I think what they tried to do didn't work, obviously, even though they're still fighting for it, as we talked about that Electoral College guy, the Rogue One guy.
Right. There are several.
He's going rogue.
It's like we've got a runner here. Yeah, it's interesting just to see the media finally acknowledging a little bit that maybe they should tone down their outrage. But at the same time, this article quoted here, it said that the TV networks will continue to highlight the glamorous, if petty, squabbles like the one between Trump and Alec Baldwin, while paying almost no attention to issues of grave importance like climate change. Again, they just keep on pointing to climate change. I don't think too many people in the country care about that issue.
No. Yeah, well, they don't have any really hard evidence that there's a lot happening. I mean, they would say they do, but I haven't seen it.
There's a solid number of scientists who disagree with it.
Yeah. And then also, I haven't heard any, how are you going to fix it? Like, what are you going to do, you know?
Yeah.
We're all going to get together, and, I don't know. Who do you talk to about it?
Right.
Mr. Climate? I mean, can you call him for a conference? I don't know.
It's interesting as well, because all of the regulations that they keep putting out there for climate change, they might save us 1 year in several thousand, but in the short term, they're hurting a lot of businesses. It's not really a well-thought-out agenda that they have.
Well, the biggest population centers in the world don't subscribe to that. You know, China is they don't care. They're just pumping whatever they want out there, and so are a lot of other nations. And so I know the thinking is, well, if the U.S. kind of took the lead, but they're like, man, go ahead, kill your economy. We're fine with that.
Yeah, one story I remember at wasn't at the Paris climate talks, but it was many years ago. It wasn't Kyoto either. It was one of the conferences in between. And BBC was interviewing a climate activist outside, and he was really frustrated because no one's listening to his idea. And they're like, okay, like, well, what's your proposition? And he said, well, my idea is to build three big machines that will pump artificial clouds into the atmosphere, so it'll block out the sun for a number of years, and that will lower the temperature, and it will stop like the greenhouse effect, because it uses the greenhouse effect.
So like he wants to create like a nuclear winter.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. He wants to stop sunlight because that's what causes the rise in temperature. But at the same time, like, that's the worst idea I've ever heard in my life. Like, so all the plants, humans, anything living will die. We'll be in perpetual winter
for
decades. But I guess that will stop climate change. When it actually will cause worse climate change.
Whenever an idea, whenever the plan begins with the words, we need to build three big machines that will, you know, it's not a good idea. Who's going to build? Because there's a lot not mentioned in there. Who's going to build the machines? How do they work? We just need to build. Why three?
Well,
10, 12?
That's odd.
I think for his obviously very detailed plans, he estimated that's the only amount he would need. But the best part of it was his earnest pleading tone, and his he's like, oh, it'd be cheap and it wouldn't cost that much money and we could solve it right away. And the BBC anchor was a woman. She just had a kind of a blank look, and then she just quickly moved on to the next thing.
Did he have it all diagrammed on a napkin?
No, he had it memorized.
He had plans.
Yeah, he memorized that napkin before the interview.
Where did you put the cloud machine? Has anyone seen that? You can get those. They're little fog machines. They can buy them. They sell them at party stores.
Exactly.
Let's make a really big one. job. Unbelievable. Well, anyway, the idea of this this article here is that the media is coming to terms with things not going their way. What do you think, Grant? Do you think they're going to change their tone or just keep on keeping on?
Well, the writer of this article on Fox News says that the coverage of Mr. Trump has gotten more substantive since he was elected, which that's probably true. The press actually loved his work saving those 1,000 carrier jobs, which there are multiple sides to that. Short term, that's definitely a good thing. Long term, maybe not. I believe Mr. Stephen Fleury talked about that last week. But they actually did think that that was a good deal, which is a lot more objective than normal. They wouldn't usually point out anything good that he did. But then what they wanted to do was look a little deeper to see if maybe the tax breaks provided to a company like Carrier could be taken advantage of by other companies in the future. That's actually an interesting thing to look into while praising the work that he did there.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what the tone they take moving forward. I guess at some point this past election will be move on and with nothing much to say or do about it. But I guess they'll be thinking about the next one. Mm-hmm. So they'll be gearing up for whatever they want to do next time. So it'll be interesting to see what happens between now and then and what the media says about things and how relevant they even are anymore.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens. But we'll put in a plug for thetrumpet.com. You should check that out. A lot of good write-ups there about some of these issues and take it from the perspective of Bible prophecy instead of a rogue one.
And the coverage is not swayed based on who is the president.
Right. Yep. Doesn't much matter. There's some things going on that'll play out the way they play out, kind of independent of who the people involved are necessarily. So make sure you check out thetrumpet.com for those headlines. You can check that on a daily basis. There's always updates there. Check it a couple of times a day if you would like to. And, hey, make it your homepage. Why not? It's free. Do it. Just do it.
Do it.
Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Radio Live today. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turch, and Abe Blondeau. Have a great rest of your day. Great rest of your Tuesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.